Let's Talk, we are going to explore the history of archiving, obviously specifically the history of archiving fan works. And we are going to start back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth before the internet existed. Flame, do you remember a time before the internet existed?
I do, actually. I have memories of these things called rotary phones.
Yeah.
No, I remember very vividly the day that we got AOL in my house.
Oh, yeah.
And the day we got a modem and how I earned getting the internet in our house.
Like you did chores and then you'd be allowed to have time online.
No. I had to do a certain number of things in order to even like get the router.
Okay.
And then it wasn't about limiting, because at that point then, like, my parents started to get really excited about how much I could learn.
Right.
So, but yeah, I was in fifth grade and I joined AOL Playbill message boards.
Yep. Cool.
And that was it. That was my first thing for fandom. So I joined in the kind of second phase that we're going to be talking about here. I was not part of the fanzines or any of the other stuff that our fandom forebearers were a part of. Was your mom?
Yeah, a little bit. Not super much, because she never really got into like the community side of things ever. So this is all kind of new for her. The fact that I'm part of the community is kind of new for her, and she's sort of still been like adjusting to that as even a concept. But she definitely remembers it, and she remembers the idea, and she's told me stories about how her and her friend used to call each other after every Star Trek episode, and they would like essentially like do headcanons and write fanfic with each other. But it was just like, you know, it was like how we talk about in fanwork chat in the Discord server. It was exactly the same thing with her and her friend on the phone, on their rotary phones, long before the internet. But yeah, back then it wasn't like people weren't doing what we're all doing now. It was on the phone, it was in person, it was through the mail. So you could drum up a friendship with an author. Maybe you meet them at a convention. And I'm going to talk about Star Trek a lot, because obviously that was the big name in fandom at that point. And it was the birth of a lot of these sorts of things becoming, I don't want to say mainstream, but within the community. And so, yeah, you could drum up a friendship with an author and they'd add you to their, like, their snail mailing list, their actual physical in your mailbox. You could get a fic. Wow. I just had the idea that I would so love to do that again. Like, write fics and mail people the chapters when they're ready.
People complain when we don't post once a week. Can you imagine if we started to make people wait for mailings?
I know. Sai does it every year in her Christmas cards, and I kind of want to do that. She writes a little fic that you only get if you sign up for her Christmas card list.
That's anyway, amazing.
I sidetracked. If anyone wants to, like, a snail mail circle with me to, like, throw it back and get something in your mailbox, let's talk. But that's how it was back then. Everything had to be that way because there wasn't another way to connect. And so groups were smaller. They were clickier. They were more localized. People couldn't travel as much or as far as often to go to conventions and hook up and meet each other. But as we talked about when Flame did her piece on the history of zines, they existed at that point and people were curating and building zines, and you could order them through the mail or you could go to conventions and buy them in person. And stuff was being spread that way. And one of the things we wanted to talk about as it carries through these sort of ages of fandom communities was that at this point, in order to get your fanfic viewed by people, there were roadblocks, not just because of location and lack of connection or access, but also because things like zines or tables at conventions were run by people. You could think of like the moderators of your favorite Discord servers. They would be people who had stepped up to take responsibility for these sorts of things, but that also meant that ultimately it was their choice what got published in a zine, which fics they wanted to focus on. And if there were any kinds of content that they didn't want to include, then it wouldn't be included. So there were definitely these barriers to, I don't want to say barriers to entry, but barriers to sharing at that point.
There were barriers to participation, sure.
Yeah, and yeah.
When we look at kind of the history of fandom, this era is when we get the most, like, now in retrospect, people are feeling free to speak about the racism and sexism that they experienced in trying to be in some of these fan spaces, especially cosplayers, early cosplayers who were trying to cosplay as a character that perhaps did not match their human race, which I'm rolling my eyes a lot right now because so much of the cosplay at the time was aliens, but
yeah,
sure. But this is now that we're having a larger conversation about representation in fandom, kind of as a people, we're starting to hear some more of these stories. And it makes sense because, like Ferret was saying, the people that ran these conventions are just the same as the people that run San Diego Comic-Con. Like, they have panels they have to fill and states they have to fill, and it's all subjective. There isn't a definition of a proper fandom except the person who has the loudest voice and the most money at some times that define what that fandom means at the time. We don't get democratization of fandom until the next phase that Ferret and I are about to talk about. And so there were quite a lot of gatekeepers and quite a lot of barriers to participation during this phase. But I love that that people still found a way to say fuck you quite a lot to the gatekeepers, and they would sometimes just create their own spaces again, which is one of the things we are so good at doing in fandom.
I think the carry through that we're going to see through this whole history talk and other talks that we've had as well is the fundamental idea of creating your own space. At the end of the day, fandom has always created its own space. And so when the internet was born in the early 80s, and it first started becoming a thing that people could connect through their computers, which were hooked up to phone lines back then, friends. You couldn't do the phone and the internet at the same time.
oh my gosh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and the modem had to dial up. We should, in the show notes, we should put a YouTube video of the modem dialing up sound for anyone who needs either an education or a nostalgic kickback.
You've got mail. Yeah.
Oh
my gosh.
So, you just blew your mic out doing that. Anyhow, so it was this capacity for sharing everything internationally, broadly, and the definition of access changed dramatically when we introduced the internet.
Even though the internet was and still remains, let me get on my minor soapbox, something that is not near as universal as we assume it to be, it is still very, very much more accessible than mail. And that's just the truth. And so the internet, the real big first thing of the internet is this page mess board, really is the best way I know how to describe it, called Usenet. They were groups of mailing lists. I'm trying to like translate this for people who were never a part of it. You know those terrible chain letters that we make fun of all the time now? A lot of us used to want to be on those because they were not chain letters. They were large mailing lists. Like if somebody has a tiny letter now or a Substack, that Usenet was the place that started from. So you could sign up to either fandom ones or individual author ones. I know I was a part of a couple fandom ones, but also a couple individual author mailing lists.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the years, they evolved. Now, these were not often multi-fandom spaces the way we see later on with FFN and kind of thing like that. At this phase of the internet, everything is still very siloed into specific topics and specific shows. The big ones in this time are Due South, which none of you have heard of, but was a really big deal.
Hey, everybody should have heard of Due South.
It's about a Canadian Mountie, and yeah.
It was one of my mom's, it was her early internet fandom was Due South. She was there for that.
Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, another one that was big.
Wow, okay, yeah.
Throwback. They're just not shows that stand the test of time, shall we say. But Buffy as well, as soon as that shows up changes.
Yeah, I think we're like, as we started to enter like X-Files. The X-Files and the Buffy zone, that was like we had Usenet and that kind of like very, very minimal, you can sign up and or view a page and see like text of certain things. That kind of sharing was developed through the 80s. And then when we hit the 90s, we enter the personal fanfic archive stage. We get GeoCities, we get Yahoo groups, and we get some of these big fan fundamental fandoms that are like the birth of internet fandom, like X-Files and Buffy and West Wing. Those were kind of foundational at that time. And so many of the personal fanfic archives were built around ships or characters or, you know, these shows and
yeah,
the relationships.
Dawson's Creek.
Oh yeah.
All the WB ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So personal fanfic archives, we did talk a little bit about already on the pod, if you caught that. But basically the idea was anybody could buy internet hosting, which you still can. And it's not very expensive. I actually think everybody should have their own web hosting account. And you could buy a domain, which is the name you type into the URL box at the beginning. And you could put whatever you wanted there. And HTML was how you could code websites, and people figured that out and they weren't that hard. And then GeoCities gave people some built-in tools to be able to do that more automatically without having to be able to code everything themselves. And so an individual person, like how me and Flame were just like, hey, let's build this podcast. A person with that kind of impetus could be like, I am going to build the Steve Tony fanfic archive website, and it's going to be called steveandtony.com.
Yeah, my very first fanfics were published on show archives, the Dawson's Creek. I've talked about this before with Pacey and Joey. And then West Wing. I was really active on a West Wing fanfic archive that was not specific to ship, but specific to show. And that was when I learned how to be a multi-shipper.
Nice.
Was West Wing. Although I'll say sidebar, my brother reminded me today that the very first fanfic I ever wrote, I was actually 9.
Wow.
Because he remembers it because I wrote him into a Power Rangers episode of television.
That's amazing.
Gave it to him for Christmas and he still has it because he gave it, he showed it to his wife this weekend.
That's amazing. I love that.
I was like, wow. He's like, this has literally been a part of your whole life. I was like, I have no idea.
That's so cute. Yeah. Power Rangers was a big one too.
Yeah. And yeah, which makes total sense because it was essentially manga in human form.
Yeah. So the thing about this was that suddenly things were so much more open and so much less gate-kept and so many fewer barriers as long as you had access to the internet, which was nowhere near as widespread as it is now, but it was starting to show up in, it was showing up in libraries, it was showing up in schools, people were having the internet at work. So this was becoming a thing. And as the 90s kicked in, people were, the idea of a personal computer, and you know, most people had a family computer. It wasn't like everyone in the family had their own computer, but you'd have a family computer that everybody shared. And that was becoming relatively widespread. And so before, if you were just writing fanfic on the phone with your friend or at home and you didn't have anyone to send it to and you didn't have the means to connect with those people, now it was like, well, hey, you know, I was into Spuffy. You could go to All About Spike, that was an archive I was in, or Elysian Fields was another one, and you could make an account and you could just post. And so for the first time, there was this absolute freedom in who could make and share stuff. And this really fundamentally changed a lot of the aspects of what it was like being part of fandom culture, because the concept of moderation changed, what was expected of community leaders, and it opened up to a lot of chaos and fandom drama, because you could have archive versus archive. Like, if you want to read the history of archives versus archives, the Harry Potter fandom has some of the best personal archive drama you will ever popcorn to. But
so intense.
Yeah, we'll link to some stuff to get you started on reading about the history of some of that stuff. But it was such a huge fundamental change that you could get, people could see your work without having to get into a zine. And this made it about you know, this opened up the question of like, should just anyone be able to post, and what is an acceptable content to share, and which archives allowed what kinds of content, and also this idea of like rating people and judging people and ranking people, is that part of the culture, was a question that continued through into FFN. And it went international, and it was such a huge difference on so many levels. And it also led to a lot of coming together of small communities and a lot of fracturing of other communities.
So then we get to kind of the turn of the millennium, and you have fanfic in particular develop along two separate strands. You have the birth of FFN, which was in 1998. And that is not centered on socialization at all. Comments are obviously allowed, but you can't reply to them, can you? Really?
No, I don't think you could. And they were called reviews right from day one.
Yeah, that's true.
It was a tone already of like, the point wasn't to send a comment to the writer. It was to provide a review for other people to judge whether they wanted to read it or not. And it really was treated that way.
And there was a lot of the holding stories hostage for a certain amount of reviews in certain fandoms. There was a lot of that kind of stuff.
It was like the currencyization of feedback.
Yeah. So you have that happening. And that was massive because it was the first multi-fandom space that in the way that we understand multi-fandom spaces now.
Yeah, it was the first like fandom list space, and that it was like, we are here to archive, to collect and archive everything. And that was sort of their approach. And if you might remember from our talks about in Hot Topic a couple of months ago, we talked about Tumblr Purge. And I think they just did it in Catch Up Club. But a lot of the backstory and history we talked about with Tumblr Purge was the various content purges that have happened in FFN and the various cutting off of areas that they have done. And if you go back and look at the start, it was much more open. There was a lot more that was allowed. And it's over its life over the last, 22 years. Oh my God, Flame, I just had a moment.
Yeah, I looked at 1998 and I was like, I was a sophomore in high school.
I'm like, that was like 10 years ago, right?
Okay. Yeah, so like one of the first stories I posted on FFN definitely had a blowjob in it. So
yeah, oh yeah, it was totally allowed back then.
Which you definitely really can't do now. So we still have the, you know, and I would argue AO3 is still quite like this. Like it kind of encourages socialization, but not really in the platform itself.
And it never intended, AO3 was never ever, it actively said that it's not a social media, it is 100% an archive. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I mean, we're about to talk about the beginning of the social media boom, but AO3 was on purpose a throwback to what it meant to archive at the beginning of the internet.
So the other stream is the infamous / beloved, depending who you talk to, LiveJournal.
LiveJournal.
Which is the, how do we get as many people together, all talking about the same thing, and creating a community online, and then my very cynical response is, and then give them the opportunity to be terrible to each other.
LJ was definitely born out of the forum idea that came before it. And yep. You know, that's part of their development concept. Because we definitely had forums before that, but forums were very much about engaging with a specific idea. Somebody would make a post about a thing, you replied to that specific thing, nested trees, all of that. LJ said, what if it's about connecting with specific people? So the idea is you connect to people, you have layers of closeness with people, friends, and I don't even remember how they did it, but you had mutuals and not mutuals, and it was all about connecting with people and building communities first, and then the sharing happened sort of as a result of building a community instead of building a community around the desire to share these things, in a sense.
Yeah, I will be honest, I gave LJ a skip So for a whole host of reasons, including that it, my personal development in that time, fandom was a more of a secret part of my life than it became in seasons. Mm-hmm. And so LJ wasn't something I really knew how to interact with. And then by the time I was ready to be like, oh, no, I'm comfortable in my own skin again. It had been happening for so long and it was so established that I was like, oh, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And so I stayed out. And so for me, fandom was a very personal thing that I didn't interact with people in it at all until this one. And so that's a huge shift and difference for me. But I think, you know, from LiveJournal, we get Tumblr, and Tumblr's that weird hybrid. People seem to think that Tumblr is some sort of archive.
It is sort of the opposite of an archive. The idea is supposed to lose things.
The idea is supposed to lose things, but like I hear people be like, well, no, you can find it on my Tumblr. I'm like, that is actually an oxymoronic statement. You cannot find anything on Tumblr, friends. But it's treated or spoken about, at least at the beginning, a little bit more like permanency and publicness than LiveJournal really was.
Well, I think that the big shift in, like, during this period of social media boom, and I will say, LJ, I don't think we said it was 1999, Tumblr was 2007. So, you know, we'd had close to a decade of LJ and the various forums and other things that spawned from that and built around that. I don't know when MySpace was, but, you know, all that kind of stuff was happening. MySpace was,
like, 99. I think Zanga and then Bebo, which was much bigger in the UK than it was in North America, but Bebo was a hybrid of Zanga and MySpace.
So I think the big shift from those types of social medias into the Tumblr and the Twitter and the Instagram style social medias is the difference between sharing, kind of like sharing amongst a community or like speaking to your friends, and this kind of like kicking stuff into a bigger, broader void and sharing things around based on content and not people, and like just this idea of like virality for the first time.
Yeah, and I think the idea of cultivating friendships too, like I was on the, like I remember when Twitter started, because like I was one of the first 2,000 or 3,000 people with a Twitter account, not intentionally, just I was doing it and been very, very bored and it seemed kind of cool. But it was kind of this understanding that like Facebook was where you hung out with people you already knew and Twitter was where you hung out with strangers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was pitched that way. Whereas like, so to speak to that. So when you talk about fandom, that's kind of we all still existed in those spaces too. Like Tumblr was obviously much, much more fandom friendly because it's much more visual. Then Facebook is hard because you have to be attached to your potentially your mandatorily offline self.
Yeah. And also, I mean, Facebook being so born out of university culture and connections and everything for so long, it was a long time before it hit a point where it was so universal that, or so broad that it had a chance at pulling at the fandom culture, and it just kind of missed its shot, really.
And honestly, it's a dumpster fire. So I'm glad we gave it a pass. and so all of this has kind of evolved, but when we're talking about archiving, obviously the pièce de résistance, the crowning achievement of our current fandom is AO3.
Yep.
And God, I love it.
AO3 was born out of a direct reaction to censorship and data loss because LJ and FFN had both suffered many, many periods of censorship, many, many experience of data loss, creators being removed, content being removed. It was a constant fear. Personal archives were dying. You know, we were now 17, almost 20 years into the concept of these personal fanfic archives, and people were losing interest, and then the hosting was running out, the domain was running out, and suddenly the website was gone. And, you know, if somebody didn't pay to keep the lights on, these things just disappeared. And you were just trusting some person, you know, and maybe they'd gotten married, had kids, changed jobs, moved away, and they just weren't doing it anymore. And so, you know, hundreds, potentially thousands of people lost access in a moment. And then, as we talked about in the Purge episode, FFN and LJ were both actively removing content for specific reasons, targeting specific groups. And so Astolat and the other people that formed OTW and the AO3 for the first time wanted specifically to make an archive, not a social media, an archive with the purpose of protecting the creators who posted there. And that has always been their mission statement, and I hope it always will be.
So if you are curious if we've always been fighting over what is quote unquote, the answer is yes. There is both annoyance and hope in that statement. So everything in fandom, all the evolutions that we just said to, that we talked about so far, the evolutions have been in reaction to something. Okay, well, we did this and it didn't work as well. And so now we have this new technology and we can do this. Well, that was kind of working, but I didn't really like it. And so we're going to try this now. But there are through lines to the human experience. And there's things that you can count on. And one of them is that someone will always have a problem with something you love.
Yep.
So if we can encourage you, like we did back in episode 4 about finding your joy and the fandom principle of first do no harm and then do you, understand that there will always be people who squick on your joy, mm-hmm. and you will always squick on someone else's joy. And that's just kind of how it works. And so understanding that cycle of fandom and the human fucking experience, to be completely frank, is going to be a really big step in freeing yourself to just like life a little bit better. There's a lot of fandom drama, and we're going to ask you how much you love fandom drama in a little bit. We all love it if we're not involved in it, I think is one of the...
Yeah, that seems to be
one of the truisms of the human experience. So in every single one of these iterations, from the zines to the cons to mailing lists to everything else, both internet and non, there have been people that have shaped what these things looked like for better or for ill. And so as you create, there are bigger fandom forces at work in a certain way, and that might really overwhelm you, but I would really encourage you to just then create what brings you joy.
Yeah.
You can't control any of the rest of this stuff. Just do what makes you happy, man.
Though I have to say the flip side to that is that the other through line that I see in this story, if you will, is that fans create fandom spaces, and the people who agree with those spaces, tenets, and missions join those spaces, and the people who don't go make their own spaces. So if you're in a Discord server and you don't like the attitude, or you don't like the tone of the mods, or you don't know what content isn't allowed or what content is allowed, make your own Discord server. If you don't like AO3, their source code is open source. It's publicly available. You can build exactly the same archive that they have and make it your own. If you want to build, you know, it costs less than $100 a year to run a website if you're just keeping it small. So if you want a place for a community, you can always make one.
Yeah. A couple people have tried to make other AO3s recently.
Yeah.
AO3 is good at what it does for a reason, but everybody can create their own spaces. And that is the other flip side of this. And also that fandom is a little bit like stubborn weeds in concrete. We will find ways to make our own spaces.
Yep.
And that's part of another Professor Flame rant I will do at another time about corporate gatekeepers.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, I think it's really strengthening and empowering and also fascinating to learn the history of the spaces that you're a part of. And I think that it also gives us that, if we have that knowledge of that history, we can prevent the things we don't want to repeat and encourage the things that we do want to see again. So you can look back and say, you know, maybe you don't always love the way AO3 works, but you can go in and research what happened on FFN, research what happened on LJ, research how hard it was before the internet existed, and find some gratitude for what we have and some understanding of what all the foundations we were building this on, so that you can engage with where you want it to go and be part of the fandom future that you want to see. And that doesn't always mean being the person who says, hey, I'm going to make an entire organization for transformative works, but you can be the person who says, you know, I want to donate here, I want to volunteer here, or I want to pitch this or post that, or engage with these people and ignore those people. And when you understand where we've come from, it gives you a really interesting and valuable perspective on where you want to go.